You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. In this podcast series, we bring international affairs expertise from Stanford's campus straight to you.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Michael McFaul. I'm the director of the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies here. Welcome. It is my great honor to mediate and moderate the Payne Lectureship today. The Payne Lectureship is named for Frank E. Payne and Arthur W. Payne, brothers who gained an appreciation for global affairs and wanted people at Stanford and in the Stanford community to think more critically and complexly. That's not a word, is it? Try again. Eric, help me. In a more complex fashion about international affairs. It happens once a year, sometimes twice a year, and we are really thrilled, or at least I'm thrilled, that Ben Rhodes accepted our invitation to come speak to you today. Ben is, I have his bio here, but it doesn't really do justice, so I'm gonna tell you a few things about him formally, and then I'm gonna tell you a few things about him informally. Ben right now serves as the senior advisor to, is that the title, senior advisor?
It's actually worse than
Chief International Advisor, I like that better, to former President Barack Obama. But before then, he was, if you know the acronyms in the government, he was an AP, Assistant to the President. In the White House circles, that means he had the same rank as the Chief of Staff and as the National Security Advisor. So there aren't very many APs in the system. After that, there's DAPs and then there's SAPs, but APs, there's nobody above an AP. Except the President of the United States, in addition to being the Deputy National Security Advisor and the Chief Foreign Policy Speechwriter, although actually Ben participated in the writing of all major speeches for the President. What you don't know when in reading his bio is that Ben has really literally been with President Obama for over a decade now. Most certainly throughout the campaign, that's when I first encountered him in 2008, actually maybe in 2007. And in the White House, not only does he do those formal jobs, but he was literally involved in every major foreign policy decision made by the Obama administration. In every major speech that the president gave about foreign policy, Ben had the pen first, and usually the pen last. And one other thing you don't know about Ben, and I'm a bit reluctant to say this given the drama with some of the offline advising that goes on in the current administration. But the geography of the White House is that the White House Situation Room is down in the basement, right, in this closed room, and the president comes in and sits down for National Security Council meetings, and he's down there, and you know, President Obama was a very deliberative person, liked the interagency process, liked to interact with everybody in the room. Our new president has a somewhat different style. But then there was always a group that I would hear about later, two or three of them that would drift up into the Oval Office and chat about these things, either right before the meetings or right after them. And Ben was always one of those people. I learned that early on working at the White House, and so I learned to cultivate my relationship with Ben as a way to get my thoughts to the president when the interagency process wouldn't work directly. So someday, in fact, he's working on the proposal right now, Ben will write the definitive book about the Obama administration's foreign policy, right before, I hope, the president writes his own. You don't want to be scooped by him. But when we talked about this talk, one strategy would be for him to try to give you a first blush read of that book that he's writing and thinking about right now. Remember, Ben has just left the government a matter of weeks ago, right? After working 8 years, January 21st, 2009 to January 20th of this year at the White House. And so if you're interested in that, and maybe over, you know, conversation we'll do that, and most certainly, you know, it's a Reddit Ask Me Anything kind of session once we sit down. But instead of doing the whole thing partially digested, I asked Ben, and he agreed instead to take one piece that he was instrumental in fact, the point person for the entire U.S. government, and that is diplomatic relations, re-establishing diplomatic relations with Cuba. And as you're going to learn from his remarks and in our questions, Ben, despite all those other jobs that I just discussed and described to you, also did that. Not a bad thing to have on your resume. So it is great that we're going to talk about the reopening and reestablishment of diplomatic relations with Cuba. But I guarantee you that if you want to ask about anything, including maybe even things in the press, Ben will answer your questions on that as well. So, Ben, without further ado, Ben Rhodes.
Thanks, Mike. Mike did always cultivate the right people. Maybe you learned that from your friend Sergei Kislyak. I'm glad to be here at Stanford. I actually applied here and didn't get in, so I feel like I'm coming full circle here. I also remember, Mike, when we brought in Better Times Dmitry Medvedev here to speak in jeans and off an iPad. Those were different days in U.S.-Russia relations. But I wanted to talk about Cuba and the role I played and how Cuba, I think, was a model of an engagement with a former adversary that is also a good prism through which to look at both the Obama foreign policy generally and also how to think about diplomacy going forward. Why Cuba? It's a question I get asked a lot. How did I end up spending more time on Cuba than any other issue over the last 4 years? I didn't start out as a Cuba expert. I wasn't a traditional diplomat. I didn't even speak fluent Spanish. But the short answer is that after the 2012 election, what happens is everybody who's in the administration picks the job that they want to do. Mike ended up going off to Moscow to be our ambassador. Samantha Power left the NSC to be the ambassador to the UN. And President Obama made very clear to me that my job was going to stay exactly the same. And it's hard to argue with your boss, especially when he's president. But he did say I should think through whether there were additional projects I wanted to take on. And the one that I chose is Cuba and trying to transform our relationship with Cuba. And it was an interesting experiment that we got to do as a reelected president. We had a meeting in the Situation Room for several hours, and we literally decided to go through the entire world and think through where there were opportunities to do something affirmative. Because when you're in government, you could spend all your time just doing the things that are in the headlines. We could have come to work every day and done nothing except work on the Middle East. And one of the opportunities that we identified was Cuba. And so we knew we wanted to do something big on Cuba. We knew it would take somebody putting time and effort into it from the White House, and so I raised my hand because I felt like we needed to do something affirmative in our foreign policy and not just reactive to the world. So let me share a few lessons that I take away from that experience about why I made that choice, what we did, and why I think it matters. And again, I think that these lessons can apply to how we think about diplomacy going forward. The first and obvious answer is that America's Cuba policy was not working. To me, that's obvious. For 60 years, the United States tried to overthrow the Castro government through any number of means, through an invasion, through assassination attempts, through an embargo, through direct funding to political opponents of the Castro regime. You name it, we tried it. And the result, the Castros remained firmly entrenched in power. But there are also a few other points that I think are very important. First of all, America's Cuba policy was a permanent anchor on our standing in the Western Hemisphere. And it's hard to overstate how much Cuba shaped our relationship, not just with the island of Cuba, but with all of our neighbors in Latin America. When we took office, it was after a period of time when actually the pendulum had swung very much in the direction of Hugo Chavez and a series of leaders across Latin America who embraced an anti-Americanism that made it impossible for us to get things done in our own region. When we first went to the summit of the Americas, the summit that brings together all the leaders in the Americas, the only issue that was really debated was why Cuba wasn't there. And the only reason they weren't there is because we spent all of our diplomatic efforts in the hemisphere blocking Cuba from coming to meetings like that. Not exactly a constructive use of time when we had serious issues to deal with, from drug trafficking to citizen security to immigration to clean energy. And what that means is it's harder for other countries in the region to work with us because the politics in their countries run against cooperation with the United States because Cuba was a symbol for how we used to treat all of the countries in Latin America. It was a symbol for history of the United States feeling like we could determine what happened with the governments and economies of other countries.
Our Cuba policy was also an anchor on our standing around the world, too, though, in a way that Americans, I think, didn't always fully understand, particularly in the developing world. And we have to remember that there are two narratives about America and the world. One is America, the liberator of countries, a supporter of democracy, an anchor of international order. That's, of course, the one that we often refer to. But the other is a history of being associated with oppression or colonization or the interference in other affairs and being less likely to care about people who are black and brown. I don't ascribe to that view, but at the same time, we have to recognize that there are incidents in history that support that view and that Cuba remained the example to other countries as to why that could still be the case. So it was hurting us in places like sub-Saharan Africa, in particular, where Cuba had been very active in the past. But above all, America's Cuba policy was hurting the Cuban people, who were supposed to be the beneficiaries of our approach. And this is the thing that was lost, I think, in Washington, where politicians would give speeches about supporting the Cuban people by continuing the embargo, but we were pursuing policies that were literally devastating the livelihoods of the Cuban people and cutting them off from the rest of the world. So that approach was not working in either changing the Castro government or in supporting a better life for the Cuban people or in advancing America's interests in Latin America or around the world. Second, things were ripening for a change in our Cuba policy. You know, it's easy when you're trapped in a conflict like the United States and Cuba have been for decades to fail to see when potential opportunities emerge. And the fact is there's also never going to be a perfect moment to reach across the type of divide that existed between our countries. And in the United States, you know, the hard line for decades essentially was the right moment will be when the Castro government is no longer in power. But first of all, that wasn't happening. Second of all, though, there was no guarantee that if that government collapsed, that what came after it would be better. And this is an important point. An evolution in Cuba, in our judgment, would be more likely to lead towards democratic change and economic change than a collapse of the existing government. As we've seen in a country like Egypt, and as Mike has spent a lot of time writing about, it's most likely that if there was a vacuum in Cuba tomorrow, it would be filled by the more retrograde elements of the Cuban military. So we felt that an evolution was important. And the fact is that leading up to that moment when we began our discussions with the Cubans, a number of signs did point towards a potential thaw in U.S.-Cuban relations. Fidel Castro had turned things over to his more pragmatic brother, Raul Castro. Raul Castro had done some initial modest reforms, but they were significant in the Cuban context, allowing a certain number of sectors to have self-employed Cubans, allowing Cubans to travel more freely from the island, announcing his own intention to step down. And our early changes in the Obama administration had also overperformed. So when we came into office, the first thing that we changed in our Cuba policy is we allowed Cuban Americans to travel freely to the island and to send remittances there. And what ended up happening is those Cuban Americans would go once to meet family. The second time they went, they'd meet Cubans who were starting these small businesses. And then the remittances would essentially be the seed money for those businesses. And this whole process started that showed us what would happen when the U.S. government just got out of the way. Because that seed money was then allowing someone to start a restaurant or a taxi service and was improving the lives of Cubans and also changing attitudes in Miami and in the Cuban American community about the benefits of that type of engagement. So we saw the potential to move things forward. A big impediment was Alan Gross, who was a USAID subcontractor who had worked on our democracy programming, bringing satellite phones and other things to the Cuban Jewish community, was in prison in Cuba. And it was going to be very hard for us to do anything big on our Cuba policy with a USAID subcontractor in prison. The third thing is, I knew that if we didn't carve out the time to make this change, it wouldn't get things done. As I said, you know, we could deal with only our inbox. But if you deal with your inbox, you don't get anything affirmative done. No climate change deal, no Iran deal, no opening to Myanmar, certainly no Cuba opening. You have to be disciplined in government and saying, I'm going to carve out X percentage of my time to actually try to do things positive, instead of just responding to the things that are coming at us around the world. So for me, that meant that starting in the spring of 2013, I had to set aside a day or two every month to travel to another country, mainly Canada, to meet with Cubans for all-day sessions. And then we had to come home and we had to figure out where things were headed in those secret discussions. And at the right moments, we had to find the time to get the attention of the President of the United States or the National Security Advisor or the White House Chief of Staff and make them focus on changing our policy towards Cuba. And it ended up being a very time-consuming effort because in our first meetings with the Cubans, I would refer to them as throat-clearing exercises. I think I sat down at the first meeting and got about a two-hour barrage of history. The Bay of Pigs invasion, efforts to assassinate Fidel Castro, the shoot down of a Cuban airliner. And the benefit I had is, in being younger, is I could say, well, look, I wasn't even born when that happened. So, I mean, like, you know, maybe there's some other people you can get upset about. President Obama wasn't even born when some of this stuff happened. But it was actually important to let that come out, to basically spend two or three days just letting the Cubans feel like they're getting off their chest their grievances so that we could actually get down to a discussion and that they could see that they could do that and we wouldn't get up and storm out and refuse to talk to them, that there had to be an establishment of a relationship on both sides. Then we also had to do things to prove that we could deliver. Small confidence-building measures. You know, for us, that could be everything from making sure Alan Gross could see his wife or have access to a computer, to getting Cuba to shift their position in some international negotiations so they weren't blocking us. And the Cubans would deliver on that. We had to do some things, too. They were a little bit more colorful. One of the Cubans who was in prison in the United States, who they wanted released from prison, they wanted to have an artificial insemination of his wife. So we facilitated that. It seemed like a good way to build confidence. It goes to show that it's never dull with the Cubans. But look, we reached multiple impasses, but because we spent the time and we didn't put too much pressure on getting things done by a deadline, we were able to find a way forward. And also because we had that time, we looked for other opportunities. And one critical one was at Nelson Mandela's funeral. We went to the funeral, and I remember saying to President Obama, look, you know, Raul Castro is going to be on the dais with you. So you're going to have to think about what you're going to do about that. And he's like, well, what is there to think about? And I said, well, you know, do you shake his hand and it'll be in front of the whole world? And he says, well, of course I'll do that. You know, for those of you who have studied the anti-apartheid movement, the Cubans had pretty good reason to be at that memorial service, having fought a war against the apartheid government on behalf of the ANC. And so he did that. And it shocked Castro. And it was interesting because in our next discussion, the entire tone was different because the Cubans saw that an American president was willing to be criticized for some personal engagement with their leader. And suddenly, things that we were talking about and arguing about, we started to find solutions to because they had been through a kind of loosely with the football situation before where America almost took the leap, but no president was willing to do it. And just that small gesture opened things up for us. And so as we built this trust, the ambition of what we're trying to accomplish rose, too. We had started by just trying to get Alan Gross released. They wanted some of their prisoners released here in the United States. We began to talk about transforming the relationship. And the guidance that we had from President Obama was, go as big as you can. And I'll come back to that. The fourth item I'd highlight is that we needed to keep it a secret. And now I have a bias towards transparency in government. Many aspects of our national security policy, I believe, would benefit from greater transparency, particularly our counterterrorism policies. But ironically, it is actually diplomacy that requires the most secrecy, particularly diplomacy around a contentious issue or with an adversary. You know, if it was a public negotiation, Congress would have taken steps to try to block it before we could get anywhere. You would have had demands coming out of both countries, from the hardliners of both countries, to take certain positions at the negotiating table. And frankly, it would have been a lot harder to have the type of open-ended conversations that we had in private, in Canadian diplomatic facilities and hotel rooms in different parts of the Americas. We knew there would be a fight when it became public about whether or not this was the right thing to do. But again, the guidance from President Obama was to go as big as we can in that first public revelation of what we were doing, so that we were starting that fight from a position of strength, from having changed things, from having upset the status quo, and so that people would be reacting to us instead of us reacting to them. So I didn't tell anybody where I was going a bunch of times. I didn't really lie about it. I just didn't tell anybody. I just wouldn't show up for work some days. And I think, you know, people were like, you know, Rhodes must kind of be losing it. He's getting a little tired. But I try to be on email occasionally and not appear to be totally out of pocket. We had to keep the circle tight in our own government. We had to manage some of the friends on the outside who wanted to change our Cuba policy by saying, well, we might be working on something. We'll tell you about it later. So we had to keep it quiet, although, you know, I was increasingly aware. At times when I would land in the airports, there were some people who looked like they're from other countries, Mike, who happened to be in the terminal. But anyway, that's another story. So we kept it a secret. But we also recognized the fifth thing is that we needed some help. We needed some help politically, which I'll get to, but we also needed help internationally. And that's what led us to the Vatican. And we had a simple problem, which is that the United States and Cuba didn't trust each other. Why would we? I liked the people I was sitting across the table with in terms of our personal interactions, but they were part of a system, just like I was, and our two systems had been, in a way, at war for decades. So how could we trust that we would keep the commitments that we were making at that table when it came time to go public? And the answer was to have a third-party guarantor in the form of the Vatican. You know, the fact of the matter is that U.S. and Cuba don't share a lot of friends in common, so it was going to be hard to select another government to play that role. But the Vatican was neutral and had standing in both countries. And the Vatican was definitely interested in playing this role, particularly after Pope Francis, the first pope from Latin America, took the position that he did. Now, we started to hear after Pope Francis took his position that they were interested in helping facilitate better relations. And when President Obama traveled to the Vatican in March of 2014, we had been in discussions with the Cubans for about 9 months. We were beginning to see the outline of an agreement to have an exchange of spies and the release of Alan Gross, and then to build out from that agreement to have an establishment of diplomatic relations and to see what other commitments we could get on either side. But we were stuck with how we could trust that each side would follow that through. So when Pope Francis raised the issue of Cuba with President Obama, it was actually the issue they spent the most time discussing. He said, well, actually, we have something going, and we'd like you to be helpful. And it was the first foreign leader that he discussed our Cuba opening with. And so then what we decided to do is to request that the Vatican offer formally to help. And so what ended up happening is the Pope wrote a letter to both President Obama and President Raul Castro that was the exact same letter. Cardinal Ortega, who was the cardinal in Havana, delivered that letter to Raul Castro, and then he had to deliver it to President Obama. So we had to figure out a way to invite Cardinal Ortega up to Washington. So we found a cardinal, or former cardinal, who was able to arrange a lecture for him at Georgetown, and then brought him in through the back door of the White House, and received that letter from the Pope. So we knew that the Vatican had essentially deposited its commitment to serve as this guarantor. And ultimately, we traveled to the Vatican in the fall when we were nearing an agreement. And what was interesting about that session is the Vatican, both because of their ancient roots, but also I think because they might know something we don't about the dangers of email communication, they don't really do things on email. So they don't really do things on open lines either. They just do it in person, which, in retrospect, is a pretty good policy. So they didn't really know anything other than the fact that they were hosting a meeting. And yet when we arrived, we had essentially developed the outlines of the deal, that we were going to agree to establish diplomatic relations, the Cubans were going to expand internet access, they were going to release political prisoners, we were going to do this swap, we were going to make some changes to the embargo. And as we're reading these things, the Vatican guys who were there kind of didn't believe us at first, I think. And so then they had meetings individually with us and the Cubans where they said, is this really happening? And when they recognized the scale of this, you know, literally they became emotional. And tears filled the eyes, I remember, of a number of the Vatican officials who were there. And it was the first instinct I got of how powerful this change would resonate around the world. It meant something to people. And I remember one of the cardinals saying, you know, in a world where there's not a lot of good news and there's a lot of conflict, just demonstrating that you're able to move beyond the past is a message that needs to be promoted. We also knew that having made those commitments to the Pope, we couldn't go back on them, because that's not a guy that you want to cross. You know, the bill could come due at the wrong time. So at that time, we knew we were ready to do this. We had an agreement in place. We had the ambition in place. We had the third-party guarantor. And this leads me to the sixth element that we needed, which is we needed to not be afraid. And I can't stress how important this is. And it's become something of my specialty to touch third rails in Washington foreign policy. But the fact is, you know, for years, most people who worked in foreign policy knew our Cuba policy was crazy and not serving our interests. And if you really pressed on why we weren't making changes, the answer was kind of, you just don't do that, that it'll be too hard. Congress will try to stop you. It'll have political problems down in Florida. But these were all psychological barriers that were, interestingly, imprisoning American policymakers. And the fact is, we just realized that we had better arguments, and we just had to have the courage to make them. And we spent some time building some support so that we knew when we took the leap, there'd be others who were with us. We spent a lot of time with the Cuban American community, which was undergoing its own generational change, where younger Cuban Americans were more open to engaging with the island. And some of the older Cuban Americans who were traveling down and connecting with family and hearing from family that they wanted the United States to make this change were shifting too. I remember Carlos Gutierrez, who was a hardliner for many years and the Secretary of Commerce for George W. Bush. He said to me he finally changed when he realized that he was tired of being on the same talking points, that those talking points bore no reality to the life that Cubans he was meeting in Cuba were living. And that's the kind of conversation was happening across the Cuban-American community. In Congress, there was an eclectic coalition emerging between progressives and the Congressional Black Caucus and libertarians who supported economic freedom and agricultural state senators and representatives who wanted to get into the Cuban market. And we helped cultivate this eclectic coalition. There were organizations that were being started in the Cuban-American community to advocate for this kind of change. So we knew that by December 17th, when we announced this, December 17th, 2014, there would be people out there who would be with us. And they were ready to have that fight. And when our body language on that day was without fear, they all felt emboldened. We weren't going to be deterred by, you know, strongly worded statements from a few members of Congress. Why should we? We were doing the right thing. We weren't going to be deterred by people calling us names. And that's a lesson that's relevant today. People want you to be afraid of the price you're going to pay for standing up for certain things. But when we had the better argument and we were willing to make it, we won that argument after December 17th, and Congress was unable to do anything to really slow down our Cuba policy. And then the last thing I would say is that we had to accept a degree of uncertainty and uneven progress as things went forward. And the opponents of change, you know, often have a card that they play because change takes a long time, and this applies to different things. The easiest way to argue against a dramatic change is to say after you make it that, well, not everything's solved yet. You know, why hasn't this happened? Why is Cuba not a democracy yet? There's still dissidents being detained. Well, yes, it's going to take time for Cuba to change, but we're making a longer-term bet on Cuba's future. And so on the one end, it meant for us that we couldn't let one incident derail the whole policy. You know, one arrest of a dissident had to be managed and addressed directly with the Cubans, but we couldn't use that as an excuse because that actually empowers the spoilers in Cuba. That would mean that anybody in the system who doesn't like our policy could have a veto over what we do because they do something to cause a provocation. We have to accept on either side that we're going to continue to be very critical of each other. So we knew the Cubans were going to continue to blast the fact that we have Guantanamo Bay Naval Base, for instance. They needed to accept that we're going to blast their human rights practices. But dialogue gives us ability to manage difficult issues. And I have to say, I have actually spent more time with the Cubans after December 17th than I did before, because it takes time to build a relationship. But we're able to get bilateral agreements across a host of issues. The Cuban economy is changing. Today, a third of Cubans are self-employed. That's a sea change from what the Cuban economy was just a few years ago. That self-employment is empowering of people. It gives them control over their livelihoods instead of having a complete dependence on the state. U.S. companies are beginning to operate in Cuba, airlines, cruise ships. There's a cancer vaccine under a clinical trial, a Cuban cancer vaccine in New York. In this community, Google is providing its cash so the internet experience is better in Cuba. Cisco has a tech academy down there. They're small manufacturing companies. And the reason this is important is, as American businesses go down there, it's not so much about profit. It's a relatively small market. But the incentive for Cuba to reform its economy changes. If the way in which they attract external business is going to require them to change the way they do business, because no company is going to want to sign on for a very arcane communist economic model. They're going to want to see that Cuba is opening up space for more creativity and a more nimble private sector. We do see internet access coming slowly through the form of Wi-Fi hotspots and broadband pilot programs. But again, what that is doing is, if you go to Havana, you go to where the hotspot is, and there are like hundreds of young people standing there with phones. And that's raising the expectations of the Cuban people. And the government can't take that away without causing a problem for itself. We often make the mistake of thinking that authoritarian governments don't fear public opinion. They really fear public opinion, because ultimately they're most afraid of a tipping point. And all these things are raising expectations among the Cuban people. We had a significant change in our migration policy so that we eliminated the program that said if you were Cuban and got here, you automatically got paroled into the country and got put on a path to citizenship, which was a way of having essentially a brain drain on the Cuban economy so that young people who want to pursue their ambitions leave Cuba. And essentially you had this country hollowing out in terms of its age demographics. We want those change makers to be in Cuba helping to change Cuba. In the region, we saw a lot of positive examples right away. The Colombia peace deal was negotiated in Havana with U.S. participation. That would not have been possible without our Cuba opening. My favorite quote from our friends in the region was from a Chilean diplomat who told me that Cuba was that rock in your shoe that you had to walk around with and was just a pain. Every time we wanted to deal with you, it was there. Now it's gone. And we've been able to expand cooperation on a host of issues in Latin America. So this is not to say that we don't have to be accountable to critics. You know, the critics who say we're not prioritizing human rights, what I've said is we are. People controlling their livelihoods, people having access to the ideas of people traveling to Cuba, people having access to information from the internet, that's empowering of people, and that's expanding space for Cubans that didn't exist before. People say, well, why do you prioritize travel? Americans are just going down there on vacation. Well, when Americans go down there, they're having conversations. The most successful American business probably in Cuba is Airbnb. And that's Americans staying in Cuban homes, paying ordinary Cubans money outside of the state, and I'm sure having political conversations while they're doing it. So there's an exchange of ideas that goes along with travel. People say, well, why engage the state sector of the economy? You know, we got some criticism because we licensed the ability for American companies to co-manage hotels. Said, well, when people go to those hotels, they eat in restaurants run by the private sector, they ride in taxis that are run by self-employed Cubans, they shop in small stores that are owned by self-employed Cubans, and so you have to engage the state sector to reach the private sector. The biggest criticism we would get is this is just going to end up like China. You know, they liberalize their economy, but not their politics. And I point out that China is a country of over a billion people on the other side of the world, and Cuba is a country of 11 million people 90 miles from Florida, with a GDP that is less than the net worth of the Cuban-American community. So I just think that that's an apples and oranges comparison. And so ultimately, that's what our policy was about, was getting out of the way, removing the U.S. government as an impediment between those 11 million Cubans and the people of the United States so that we could build a new relationship and so the Cuban people could have more resources to make their own choices. And this is important, not our choices. I don't think we should pick the next government of Cuba. I don't think that we should only insist that people who receive our democracy funding are the only viable political actors in Cuba. The best thing that would happen is if the person who runs Cuba in 10 years is someone who I have no idea who they are today. So it's not necessarily the current regime, but nor is it necessarily the opposition we funded. It's a decision that Cubans have made on their own. And ultimately, even with the uncertainty of the current administration, which I'm sure we'll discuss, I think this policy will survive because the American and Cuban people want it to. Every public opinion survey shows that. There's enormous interest in building relationships between our countries. There are personal stories that validate that. I remember going with President Obama, and the thing that strikes you when you fly into Cuba is it takes about 10 minutes to get there from when you cross over Miami. And the absurdity of this policy is on display when you make that journey. And then I remember him being in a hall where we had negotiated painstakingly with the Cubans, and we could invite half the people, and they invited the other half. And so you had Raul Castro and the invitees of the government, but then you had Cuban Americans who had opposed the Castro regime, young Cuban entrepreneurs who worked with our embassy, and they were all there together, and they were equally excited that this was happening. And I think, to me, that is ultimately what diplomacy should try to bring about, which is a circumstance where you remove the source of tensions between countries and then allow people to build relationships that benefit them in terms of commerce, exchanges, and ultimately the empowerment of people to make their own decisions around the world. So I look forward to remaining engaged on this, and I look forward, Mike, to probably answering questions about many other things as well, but I'd be more than happy to talk more about Cuba. Thank you.
Ben, that was excellent. Thank you for your remarks. Thank you for your service. That's a big thing. That's a big deal to get done. Didn't the president say in 2010 we do big things?
Yes. The vice president said something else, but
that's right. That's right. Well,
it's a big effing deal.
Right. Big effing deal. And we're on the record. I want to remind people. Let me ask a few questions about Cuba, and then I want to open it up and turn to people to talk about other things. The first question is about us and our interagency and our White House and you. So Ben is the Deputy National Security Advisor for Strategic Communications, STRATCOM is what we called it, and speech writing. So it's not intuitive to this audience, let alone to the State Department, let alone, I would guess, even to Secretary John Kerry, speaking of diplomacy, that you would be the point person for this policy. So tell us a little bit about, first of all, why Obama had that faith in you. That's not intuitive to me either. That came out wrong. Terms of the bureaucracy, the interagency, and how, I mean, there must have been a conversation between the two of where you made the case to him. And then, in particular, I'm interested. I mean, if I were Secretary Kerry.
He was not happy.
Tell us how he reacted to this whole thing.
Well, look, so first of all, why me? It was interesting. So my wingman on this was a guy named Ricardo Zuniga, who was a Foreign Service officer who was detailed to the White House as our Senior Director for Latin America, for the Western Hemisphere. And first of all, just an extraordinary guy who knew more about Cuba than anybody in our government and had all the right instincts. So Ricardo deserves a lion's share of this credit.
Where is he now?
He's the Consul General in Sao Paulo, which is probably a good place for him to be.
Okay.
Ricardo's analysis, which was borne out, is that the Cubans would care about one thing and one thing only. in setting up this channel. And I should have said, what we did is we sent them a message in the spring of 2013 saying, let's have a meeting. And they jumped on it. And the people they sent, who I have not revealed, because I think that's up to them to reveal, were of a sufficient stature in their system that we knew they were serious. Okay. But they wanted proximity to the president. That's their system. That's how their system works. That they wanted someone who would speak with authority for Obama. And so number one, they wanted a White House person because they wanted to know that when I got back, I was telling Obama what happened and it wasn't going through a process.
Right.
Number two, they didn't want their foreign ministry involved in the discussions for the same reason. They wanted to keep it tight on their side and have it be direct to Raul Castro. And so therefore, it would have been awkward, I think, for the State Department to engage. I put it this way, the people I was engaging were not John Kerry's counterparts.
Right.
And so therefore, it was in kind of a different type of channel. Third, frankly, we would have been putting the State Department in an incredibly awkward position because they have an oversight relationship with Congress that we don't have. Where, you know, if Roberta Jacobson was involved, the Assistant Secretary of State at the time, she testifies all the time, and all she gets asked about is Cuba. What are you doing on Cuba? It would have put her in an untenable position to try to have a secret negotiation. So to have a secret negotiation, we almost had to start it in the White House, at least. So I think those are the right decisions in general. I think Obama trusted me because he knew, I mean, this will sound strange, but you've been around the block, Mike. As you might note from some of the commentary about me, I did not live the last 8 years worried about a future Senate confirmation. I was just worried about getting his agenda done. If the Cuba negotiations had crashed and burned and there was some big public dust up, you know, I was willing to take that risk in a way that I think others wouldn't. And I think Obama knew I was going to go into those negotiations with one purpose, which was to get what he wanted done. So he trusted me in that regard. When the State Department found out about it, they weren't happy.
So the initial group was just the two of you?
Yeah.
Like your entourage was two?
Two. Well, yes. We brought three, actually. The first couple discussions we brought Randy Blake, who was our counterterrorism guy at the NSC, because we were having a counterterrorism dialogue.
Okay.
Because we felt like that way at least we're doing some business that, you know, was kind of bulletproof, right? Who would be against talking to them about counterterrorism?
That was just smoke cover.
Yeah. We had some issues to raise, but they're very minor. Uh-huh. But then it was the two of us, yeah.
Okay.
And that's all it was.
So then they found out, and how did the secretary react? Did he understand the logic?
Yeah, he did. He did. I think he just, I think in his defense, he wanted to do something in Cuba, so like he supported
better Cuba than some of the other.
Yeah, no, he supported.
Portfolio.
Yeah, like and so I that's a fair point that he had, but I don't think. And what I said to him is, I don't think he like his interlocutor would not have done this. Bruno Rodriguez, the foreign minister, would not have been able to do this.
Right.
And so it just by definition had to be done White House to the Castro inner circle.
Well, so that gets me to my second question about the two leaders. Tell us first about Obama. I could see this as two different kind of explanations about why he decided to do this. One was one re-election. You come up with some ideas, and he says, "Okay, Rhodes, go knock yourself out." But he thought that if this works, it works. No big deal. Or it was like, "Okay, we've got a few good years left. I really want to get this done." So tell us about his mindset at the time.
It was both of those things because he wanted to get something done on Cuba for a long time. I mean, there's not a conversation we ever had where he wasn't like, "This is ridiculous," but how do we find the right moment or how do we structure it? And this is something I should have said too, like the risk was on the Cuban side, not ours. I mean, we didn't give anything up. We got to have diplomatic relations with Cuba and all the benefits and our standing in the region and
Whereas they're opening the door to
right.
huge uncertainty, right?
Yeah.
So we may get to that on the other.
We are going to get to that, yeah.
But for Obama, so for Obama's view was, we lose nothing, the way in which this relates is, we lose nothing by letting Ben go see if he can do this and test it. And I would really like to do it. But it wasn't like a must do, like the
right.
world will be, you know, that this will... there was no downside, really, to just
uh-huh.
testing the proposition.
Uh-huh.
So that's why it's a mix of the two. Like, he wanted to do it. He felt it was worth, like, putting in the time and letting senior people put in the time. But at the same time, you know, if this hit a roadblock because the Cubans just, you know, were intransigent, we lost nothing
right.
by doing it.
Well, and then you mentioned the Cubans, but say a little bit more about that. And in particular, I'm interested in, you know, this has been stuck for a long time, and now it's unstuck. We social scientists want to understand the factors that led to the breakthrough, right? So, and you've helped us with some of the ones you talked about. How important was it that Raul became the leader?
It wouldn't have happened otherwise.
Okay.
You know, and this is a big, and this is, I mean, I could have, you know, expanded that. Another lesson is we make a mistake, and this does relate to the mission of this institution, in thinking that authoritarian governments are monolithic. They're not. There's a diversity of opinion within the Cuban Communist Party, just like there's a diversity of opinion in any group
right.
of people. Fidel was always at the far end of the hard line. Raul was always, yes, invested in the revolution completely, 100%, but he was pragmatic about how you kept that going. Remember, he was the one who had to keep the place running in the 90s when they lost the Soviet subsidy.
Right.
So he knew the wiring, where Fidel was kind of the guy out front. Raul was the guy who had to solve the problems. And, you know, I think he looked around and he realized that, you know, they have a diminishing subsidy from Venezuela as that government becomes unstable. They never said this to us. This is just my
right.
analysis.
Right.
They, you know, they have an aging population. They're getting, you know, this private sector experiment that he made was, yes, making some hardliners in the country nervous, but it was also improving conditions in certain communities. I think he was willing to test the proposition that they could begin to liberalize their economy. You know, he has stated publicly more ambitious goals in terms of unifying their currency, in terms of shifting their model. And he's just trying to figure out how to get there. So I think he has a pragmatic streak that, coupled with the options that they were looking at, led him to believe that he would take the risk. And this is the last point I'd make. He also, I think, believes he is strong enough to begin to make these changes in ways that his successor wouldn't be. So I think for him, the time was right, because, you know, if he waited too long or till he left the scene, the next leader actually might not have been able to take the leap of establishing diplomatic relations. It would have been too politically difficult for them.
Right.
So if anybody was going to start this process from within the current leadership structure, it had to be him.
So leaders matter.
Oh, I can tell you, you know, and this is
had a lot of leaders.
Well, no, but you put this into social science, political science context. It's a hard thing to account for, but Dmitry Medvedev is the president of Russia. We got a lot done that I'm glad we got done. When he no longer was, we didn't. If Yitzhak Rabin had been the, you know, prime minister of Israel during Obama's tenure, you know, we'd probably be talking about the two-state solution. Prime Minister Netanyahu was. The personality of the foreign leader and the politics of that country at a moment have a lot to do with where there are opportunities and where there are problems in
right.
ways that, you know, I think you never really realize until you're in government.
I agree with that. In fact, I'm writing a book about it right now, about one country, not all of them. But let me ask you about this longer horizon inside Cuba, and particularly about, you know, the long game. About democracy there. So your critics, of course, say, well, you gave up on democracy and human rights to do this, and you engage with these dictators. You alluded to it in your own remarks. But tell me, where you personally feel the story is right now inside Cuba. I have to tell you, I knew you were coming, and I was in Munich a couple weeks ago, so on the flight home, have you seen this movie yet? The Rolling Stones performing in Cuba?
No.
You probably haven't, because you didn't have... You're on a 12-hour plane ride...
movies in 8 years.
Well, okay, the next time you're on a plane ride to Burma, Cuba wouldn't be enough time. You should watch this movie. It's really great. It's great in two ways. One, it reminds me of when those kinds of groups came in the early days in the Gorbachev period.
Yeah.
And the excitement. I saw Dan Snyder here earlier. There's Dan. I mean, you know, you remember that period, right? This excitement about the future. And he says a few words about it feels like change is here. You know, yeah. Mick Jagger does. And everybody screams and everybody's crying. The other thing that's really inspirational about it, that you could play the same song for 50 years and still make people scream. That's inspiration for me as I do the same Russia talk. And I think, does anybody really want to hear this? But they still want to hear Satisfaction. So there's even that minor inspiration. But tell me where you feel like right now. Yeah. Like how does it feel? Is it moving?
Look, first of all, you talk to people, like I said, in Washington, say, well, there's still these harassment of dissidents. But you talk to people in Miami or in Cuba, and they're like, things are changing faster than they ever have.
Right.
You know, and they still want them to change faster, but there's this complete discordance. There are a few points I make. First of all, just the premise of the question always upset me, because it's not like what we were doing, the Castros were just about to liberalize. You know, if we just squeeze them for a few more months, you know, the dissidents would be released and so the counter theory had been proven wrong for like 60 years. I mean, that's evidence that, you know, we should respond to. That's the first point. The second point is the liberalization on the economic side, I believe is a human rights issue. And it's interesting that I'm a Democrat, I'm a pretty liberal Democrat, making an argument that usually used to be made by the Republicans, but a lot of things have changed. A good anecdote a Cuban-American friend of mine told me is, and I won't swear, I'll use the shorter version, but he said, you know, he went down there, you know, and he talked to somebody and said, well, how are things on this front? And he said, look, 2 years ago I worked for the state, and they'd come knock on my door and say, you have to be at the rally at 11 a.m. tomorrow. And I'd go, because I worked for them. Now I have this business, and they come and knock on my door and say, you have to be at the rally at 11 a.m. tomorrow. And I say, F you, I'm busy. And that's breaking a dependence, and it's empowering people. That doesn't mean that person can vote in an election or can demonstrate, but that means that they are feeling a greater control over their lives. And as I said, people are traveling, and they're being exposed to ideas that they weren't previously exposed to. If they can get online, they're accessing information that they couldn't previously access, and it's a small place. And so I'm optimistic about that front. The other thing I'd say is the Cuban, if you care about human rights, they're comfortable with, you know, the status quo, the protest, you know, like a bunch of people protest, they go break it up, they throw some people in prison, they let them out of prison the next day, and this happens every weekend, you know. That's not going to change Cuba. That doesn't mean there's not a role for protest. It's important. But there needs to be a broader policy. Yes, we need to support dissidents. Yes, we need to speak up and try to get people out of prison. I got a bunch of people out of prison. We had 53 of the most prominent dissidents released in December 17th. We advocated relentlessly for them to be able to travel out of the country so they could make contact. So I'm not saying it doesn't have a place. I'm saying it has to be connected to a broader strategy where we're using, yes, our direct support for democratic change, but also our support for economic liberalization and people-to-people ties. And we have to have the confidence of our own people. Let Americans go down there and talk to Cubans. And then we also have to have the respect, though, to say, we're not going to change your regime. Like, this evolution is going to be decided by Cubans. And so we said publicly, regime change is not our policy. And no one had ever said that before. But if we, by saying that, we just gave them their best talking point to use in justifying their repressive tactics and mobilizing their supporters in Latin America. So a lot of what we did, we're just removing the United States as a justification for those tactics.
Right. Well, two more questions and I'll open it up, okay? So This approach that you described in your remarks was not just a Cuba approach. In fact, I'm pretty sure you wrote the line in the president's first inauguration address about the clenched fist and opening it, right? Or was that
President Obama?
President Obama wrote that. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But remind us. I think
he did actually, though.
He did.
Well, I remember he. Well, there was a line but the way that people always ask about these lines, and usually what it ends up being is like some mix of, you know, there's a line, and then he changes it, and he says, "Is there a more interesting way to say this?" And then you try to write it that way, and then he refines it. So the interesting thing about speech writing is it's often hard to truly identify exactly who the author was. But that's a side note.
No footnotes in government, I used to tell people, right? But I remember the line well, and I remember those early weeks and months of redefining our policy. And you could put on that list back then, you could put Cuba, Iran, Burma, Russia, and maybe some other countries, right, where we had pretty tense relations and we made efforts to do things different. There's variation on that list, right? So some worked out better than others.
Yeah.
Quickly, I would say Cuba and Burma feel like they're moving forward. Iran and Russia, we got the Iran, you and we, and then you after I left, got a big Iran nuclear deal done. But, you know, I think in the back of my mind, at least, that this engagement and of the regime, we were hoping for something more. That's just my opinion. Most certainly on Russia, we were hoping for something more. So kind of two out of four, do you have a theory to explain?
Yeah, I have a theory. So my theory is that we got as far as we could with each one based on how far we could push or incentivize those countries.
Okay.
The farthest is Burma. They decided to change their political system. And so that was transformative. Then Cuba. They decided to change their relationship with us fundamentally and completely, but not their political system. So that was a different amount of progress. The Iranians decided to do a very specific transaction with us. They didn't change anything except the nuclear deal. And we didn't change anything except the nuclear sanctions. So we still have all these other problems, but we got that transaction done. So on that spectrum, you know, the Iranians, no change in the relationship with the United States, but a change in their nuclear program. The Cubans, a complete change in the relationship with the United States, but no change in their political system. The Burmese decided to change their political system for reasons that we can discuss. With Russia, what I always say is, if we didn't do what we did in the first term, we actually wouldn't have gotten an Iran deal. That's, people forget, that's where we got the sanctions put in place through UN Security Council Resolution 1929. New START allowed us to bolster the non-proliferation regime. In government, you have to take the opportunities that are there while you're there.
Yeah.
And just because Russia didn't end up following through on those things is not a retrospective reason to say, well, then we shouldn't have done those things while we had the chance.
Right.
It's all the more reason to take advantage of it while you have it.
While you have,
you got to take the opening while it's there.
Right. No Barack and Raul, you know.
Yeah.
Let's end with that, and then I'll open it up, which is to say, we now have a new president. You tweeted about him last night. I think 60,000 people retweeted. Are you up to 60,000 now, Ben? Follow Ben on Twitter. He's quite interesting and entertaining, and also important policy things that he says. New to Twitter, not in the controlled environment of being at the White House. So it's a lot more interesting to read, I'll tell you honestly. I've read both Rhodes's.
It's a little constrained.
A little constrained. But how worried are you about rollback of what you did with Cuba, with the Trump era? Has a train left the station, as Gorbachev used to say?
I think so. I mean, I think that they will be of different minds on this issue. They have a strong element of favoring commercial deals in other countries, and Cuba is ripe for that. They have a political faction that is invested in a hard line. And so I think you'll see kind of dueling policies, which might make it hard to make a lot of progress. But rolling it back will be, as I said, that people want this policy here and there. And why take a, why create a problem for yourself when you don't need to? But, you know, they have surprised me in other ways. So I won't hazard any more predictions. But I do think that what can be rolled back is this psychological barrier that we broke. We're just in a new space, and there's just a new dialogue. And like more Americans have traveled to Cuba in the last 2 years than the previous however many years. And Cubans have been exposed to things, and their expectations are up. And so I think it's what cannot be rolled back is that threshold we've crossed as countries and as populations. And that, I think, is ultimately what's going to be most beneficial to the Cuban people anyway.
Okay, floor is open. Yeah, please, Jake. And everybody, if you could identify yourself and then ask a question.
Hello, Mr. Rhodes. I'm a sophomore named Jake. I study political science. I'm an undergrad. My question's about selling foreign policy. Both from the left and the right, we're kind of in an era that rejects an internationalist foreign policy, skeptical of international organizations and just international action generally. Without the shadow of the Cold War, the post kind of 9/11 era of the war on terror, how do you sell a public that's skeptical of an internationalist policy on such policy?
Well, it's a good question. I think that for the American people, and I think we're about to learn what happens when we lose it. We take for granted how much our degree of prosperity, our standard of living, our relative safety and security is dependent upon this international system that we've built. And in terms of how we sold policies, oftentimes we just try to connect that the interests of people to what we're trying to do. With Iran, people weren't necessarily experts on nuclear, physics and centrifuges, but we therefore had to distill it. There's three ways this story ends. Either this country basically either acquires a nuclear weapon or is on the threshold of having one, or we go to war with them to stop them from doing that, and we're in another war in the Middle East, or we make a diplomatic resolution to this that at a bare minimum buys us 10 to 15 years of Iran having a verified and constrained and limited nuclear program. What are the stakes involved? And people don't want to have a war in the Middle East, and they don't want to have Iran have a nuclear weapon. They understood that. We tried with Cuba. I think just personally, people want to travel there and they want to go there. So when I would sell it, I'd say, well, why do you want a policy where your government tells you can't go down to Cuba? People get intuitively. So some of these things, it's just a matter of trying to connect to them personally what their interest is. I think what was harder is the global financial crisis caused a sense of unease around the world in ways that were hard for us to respond to that led to this kind of right-wing populism that we see, in that when people feel that extreme sense of insecurity that went along with that financial crisis here and in Europe and other places, they tend to retrench back into their tribe or their race or their nationalism. And that's just the instinctive reaction to losing the sense of security that came with the catastrophic nature of that financial crisis. And so connecting, while we could sell or advocate for individual policies, even though President Obama did this over and over again, he tried to explain why the international order and the process of globalization was still fundamentally in our interests, why a network of alliances was in our interests. He was increasingly an isolated figure in the world on that, because basically the wave was building in the opposite direction while he was there. But my hope is, and what I'd look for optimism is that I don't think the other way works at all. And I think we have a model for where the pendulum swings back that we have to continue to refine. So I think, again, on individual policies, you can connect it to people's lives. But there now is there's an effort that we couldn't quite do to connect the broader project of the liberal international order to people's lives. And frankly, the thing that is going to connect that to their lives is what happens now. Because there are going to be terrible consequences from the erosion of American leadership of that international order. And it's going to make the case for that international order better than any speech that anybody could give. Not to end on a down note, but.
We got more time to go up. I saw somebody over here. I'm sorry.
Hi, I'm Josh Adamson. I'm a freshman here. I'm studying history.
Oh, fantastic. I chose a freshman. That's what I wanted to do.
My question is regarding speech writing, especially in a foreign policy speech. What do you do first? What's your process in writing a successful speech, either with Obama or just anyone in general?
Well, so I think that, first of all, just in terms of an individual speech, for any speech, it has to sound like the person who's giving it believes it, and it's who they are. What I used to ask people to do as a thought experiment is the Yes, We Can speech that he gave in New Hampshire that became this sensation. If you close your eyes and imagine another politician giving that speech, it would be absurd. George W. Bush or John Kerry or Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump delivering the Yes, We Can speech would be absurd. But Barack Obama, it was authentic. It's who he is and what he believes. So for a successful foreign policy speech, a big speech, I would sit down with him for an hour, and he would just tell me, here's what I want to say. Here's the argument I want to make. Here's some points I want to make. Here's the structure of the speech that I want to give. And tell a story. Don't just say, here's a 7-point list of my policy proposal. Basically, if you look at every Obama foreign policy speech, it's how did we get to where we are? What is the problem? What is the solution? And why do I believe that's right? It's a story about whatever he's talking about. So then you have to get, obviously, all the inputs from people like Mike to fill in those gaps. And then you edit. There's an editing process where the policy advisors get the edits. And as a speechwriter, what's difficult is you become like a goalie. Because on the one hand, you have to make sure that the policy is right. But on the other hand, if you took all the edits from people like Mike, you would lose Obama. No offense. You'd lose that authenticity in that voice. So you become like an editor in that regard. And then the speech would go back to Obama, and then he would just chip away at it. He'd just edit it, and we'd have draft after draft. So that was our process. But again, the authenticity point is a key one. And the other point that's important is that there has to be a common thread. Obama is a successful politician, and I think the most successful politician I've ever seen, because his farewell address was the same as his 2004 convention speech. The message was the same, and it was clear and understandable to people here and around the world. How many other politicians could you say that about? And so that consistency and authenticity, everything has to be. I told some of the speechwriters we hired, every speech is part of one speech. Every speech is part of one story that Barack Obama's been telling since 2004, if not before. And if you have that approach to it, you can maintain that authenticity.
Do you have a favorite speech?
I think personally, I love the speech he gave in Cuba because it was tied to something I'd worked on and it was this historical moment. I also really liked his Nobel Peace Prize address because I think it's a window into his mind and his worldview and what informs it. And what you and I were talking about before, his mix of having a fairly well-developed sense of realism about what the world is, but also still maintaining a sense of idealism about why, in the face of that, we need to keep working for change. He gave a version of that didn't get as much attention here in Hiroshima that is also one of my favorite speeches.
Interesting.
If you want to know Obama's mind, read Hiroshima. The speech in Hiroshima.
Great. In the back, yeah.
Hi, my name is Jeremy Jimenez. I just finished my PhD in international education, and I'm a Cuban American, so thank you for making life easier for my family. My question is, there's often a lot of discussion about GOP obstructionism with policy, but not as much discussion about bureaucracies. So I'm curious if you could talk about, either generally, specifically, what obstacles you had to deal with, either geographically or thematically, in terms of getting Obama's agenda forward.
In the U.S., within the U.S. bureaucracy?
Yeah.
Let me begin by saying, I draw no comparison. The current attack on the bureaucracy goes far beyond anything I would say. They're talking about a deep state and Look, there's civil servants who come to work. There's no deep state in the United States. You know, go to there are any number of other countries you could go to see what a real deep state is. There are entrenched habits. I'll take Cuba as an example, actually. Even after we change our policy, Caroline Kennedy became a friend of mine, and she was our ambassador in Japan. Obviously has a family history with Cuba, but was a huge proponent of changing this policy. And so she said she wanted to send a message and invite the Cuban ambassador in Japan, she was our ambassador in Japan, to tea. And the State Department rejected her ability to do that because they had a policy that you couldn't have any contact with Cuban diplomats in other countries. This is after December 17th. Huh. And I was like, well, guys, we just changed the policy, you know? And that kept happening. You know, there were these things would happen where just the bureaucracy was designed to, you know, not invite Cubans to the 4th of July event at the embassy or right. to, you know, try to mobilize opposition to Cuba's agenda everywhere. And it didn't, it was just, some people even did that, didn't agree with it, but it was just the way you did things. It took a long time to change that. One more example. We support travel to Cuba, it's a good thing. But there was a license that got held up at state for aircraft going through Maine to Cuba to be able to refuel there because the practice had been to prevent any tourism from Europe to Cuba. But our policy had changed. So there was this tail in the government that we kept running into, right? That's just on Cuba. I think in terms of like the another issue I'd highlight is the war on we inherited as a global war on terrorism and kind of tried to make a more focused effort against terrorist organizations. The amount of just funding and momentum that was invested in that effort to be almost a self-sustaining, open-ended resource conflict. That was a very hard thing to turn around. And that has to do with everything from like troop requests for Afghanistan to how we spent foreign assistance money. Everything was through a terrorism prism and just kind of trying to right size like the resourcing of, and again, that wasn't because there was bad intent in the bureaucracies. It's that the bureaucracy is an ocean liner that I felt like the first term, we were still just kind of turning the ocean liner around and pointing it in a new direction. I think both the habitual instinctive direction and also just the momentum that comes from heavily resourced projects are just two examples of how it's hard to make a hard pivot as the new administration is finding out and responding to in very, authoritarian ways.
Over here. Another freshman, right?
Yeah. It is on. Hi, I'm Isaac Kippist. I'm a freshman here. And I was wondering if you could talk about how the Obama administration communicated the Iran deal to our allies in the Middle East and how they reacted to the Iran deal. And then if you think we did so successfully or if we could have maybe communicated it in a better way to make sure that there was a lot of trust in those relationships.
Well, I divide it into two. You had Israel and then you had the Gulf states. With Israel, we couldn't have done. I mean, we literally. Mike, you were still at the NSC for some of this. I mean, I don't know that there's any other issue that we had more dialogue with another country about than our dialogue with the Israeli government about their Iranian nuclear program. I mean, we would send over you know, the National Security Advisor, the CIA Director, the Secretary of Defense, the Chairman of the Director, we'd send these huge teams over to just do nothing but sit there and share our assessments of the nuclear program and sanctions enforcement and other Iranian actions. So we were very transparent with the Israelis. There was one period of time when we launched the secret negotiations in Oman where we didn't do that. And the Israelis often point to that as a breach of that trust. But the fact is, as soon as that led anywhere, we sat down and went through everything with the Israelis in terms
that
of...
That was Burns and Sullivan,
That
right?
was Burns and Jake. And so...
Jake Sullivan's coming early May to speak here as well, just so
you
should
know. See him. He's great. But at the end of the day, we just had a disagreement. You know, so I don't know if there's anything we could have done differently because... But what was hard to discern is what the disagreement was about. And what I mean by this is, you know, there was the specific question of their nuclear program and what constraints were necessary in a deal. And then there was this question of their other behavior. And we felt like we were literally taking Israeli ideas into the conversation on the constraints in the nuclear program. And the deal that came out, senior Israeli security people in the IDF and the intelligence community there, they're pretty happy with it because it removes a strategic threat to them for at least a decade, and they'll take that, right? The prime minister, you know, basically would expand the question to be these other elements of Iranian behavior, which were never going to be in the deal. You know, like we were never. If you looked at his speech to Congress, it was, you know, well, why are they still allowed to support terrorism? And we were not. Aiming, you know, the Iranians were never going to agree to that, and nor could our allies, you know, join us in insisting that be a part of the deal. And I always felt like if the question is about whether our policy should be regime change or not, let's just have that debate. You know, I felt like we were always kind of talking around an issue here where we were essentially saying, yeah, we're not going to change this regime, but we're going to make a deal to make sure this regime doesn't have a nuclear weapons program. And yet the goalposts seemed to move on the Israeli side. So I felt like there was a disagreement that we would never resolve, and we weren't even really surfacing like the core issue, which was any nuclear deal ever going to be acceptable to the Israeli government, or was there a point that we just needed to change this regime? And I'm not saying I have the answer to that question, but I felt like we were kind of talking around a core issue. The Gulf countries, you know, they were fine with the nuclear deal, I think, but they just have huge concerns about Iran. And they felt, in general, like we weren't doing enough to address those concerns. So that the deal would, you know, perhaps lead us to a better relationship with Iran, and that might lead us to put their interests secondary. So what we did is we had a summit with all of the Gulf countries, and we said, look, let's talk about what capabilities you need. Let's talk about how we can help interdict Iranian weapons shipments, and let's talk about what missile defense capabilities you need. And that helped. It didn't erase their concerns, but I think it did at least say, like, look, we get it. We're making a deal about the nuclear program. We share your concerns on these other issues. So I think that helped, but I still think, you know, they felt a degree of mistrust that you know, that we were even in these discussions, and that is what was in common with the Israelis, because it was like, well, what is the alternative? I mean, should this be a regime change policy, or do you understand why it'd be better to have this regime that we don't like not have a nuclear weapon? That was always our argument. We agree that they're all the things you say. They support terrorism, and they're just destabilizing in the region. All those things would be much worse if they had a nuclear weapon, so we're at least trying to solve that problem. So I think the main question for the new administration is, you know, where do they land on that spectrum?
Yes.
I just wanted to thank you personally for coming to speak at Stanford. We're actually both Cuban immigrants, and well, he came like 4 years, 4 or 5 years ago, and I came 15 years ago. And we just wanted to thank you for, you know, taking a really big step in what has meant like a lot to both of our families. Just 2 weeks ago, we were hosting a group of Cuban entrepreneurs here at Stanford who won the 10x10K.
I know. I actually am familiar with that, yeah.
Yeah, and we were super lucky to have them here and to show them around. And they were actually able to talk to Larry Diamond in a panel that we hosted. And then we got to show them around like Google and like Facebook and Airbnb. And what that showed us was that, you know, really taking advantage of these educational opportunities means a lot to Cubans, especially Cuban entrepreneurs. So my question is, how do you think that institutions like Stanford and other universities can really leverage the power of education to facilitate more like strategic exchanges between Cuba and the U.S. while maintaining a very objective stance and just like really pushing for development between the two countries?
Well, you know, let me say a couple things. First of all, the Cuban American community, you know, it's been, you know, before our trip, I felt like I had talked to like a majority of Cuban Americans in the country, but the input was essential in shaping our policy and everything we did. And so, you know, people like you were like the authors of our policy as much as anybody else. The second thing is related to Mike's point, entrepreneurs, you know, when you're promoting democracy, sometimes you have to listen to the people who you're promoting democracy on behalf of. and they will tell you to do what we're doing. And even a number of the dissidents who, you know, occasionally publicly criticize us would privately be like, no, keep doing what you're doing, you know. In terms of what institutions like Stanford can do, I think that exposing, you know, there's something very empowering to people like that, being able to come to an institution like this and feel like they, you know, not only are they getting skills, but also they're meeting other people and they're being validated for what they're doing. And it gives them a degree of confidence and it raises their expectations. But another area the policy area that I became, you know, interested in is we're obviously limited in some of the things that we can do with the state sector of the economy because there's still an embargo and the Cubans still have a very mixed model. But there is a huge space in the world of philanthropy and foundations that needs to be taken advantage of in Cuba. Because that is now authorized. We authorize that. And the Cubans actually are open to that. And so I think there needs to be an openness to working together on everything from, you know, humanitarian work, you know, how to increase crop yields in Cuba, historical preservation in Cuba. There's all kinds of space for research universities and foundations and philanthropies to, you know, not just promote exchanges, and I think they should, in two-way exchanges, but also to promote large-scale research collaborations, because that's actually an open space, and there's not as much activity happening there as there could be. So I actually have encouraged large foundations and research universities to think about exchange programs, yes, and short-term exchanges like the one you say, but also like, you know, more structural collaboration across Cuba, because, you know, you have an educated population, you have a lot of needs, and Americans are interested, and I think donors are interested, and, you know, so I think it's a thinking big in this space is a worthwhile thing to do.
So I get the last question, and that means that you get the penultimate question.
Hi, my name is Chris Ye. I am a junior at Stanford studying computer science.
I just interrupt and say that you oftentimes when we have lectures like this, it's totally dominated by the faculty. So it's really awesome that all these students have shown up and asked their questions. So glad we're ending with a student. Thanks.
Thank you. I'm also a member of the Stanford Symphony Orchestra, and I'm really excited to be going on tour this summer in Cuba, in part to your efforts. I just wanted to ask what your thoughts are on the role of art and the humanities in bringing about change in foreign governments such as Cuba, whether it's music or movies or other forms of art.
Yeah, I think that it's incredibly important in a place like Cuba because it's a place to begin. You know, we're still going to disagree with them on a lot of issues as a government. we're limited in our economic two-way trade because of our laws and theirs. But, you know, there's a common language that, and this is another reason why I think Cuba is in a different space than, you know, a China, as much as we also share things in the arts and humanities there. You know, we're so close and have so many family ties that in music and athletics, you know, baseball and reggaeton, and I mean, there's just like an overlapping culture that is a space, I think, for collaboration. And, you know, Misty Copeland just went down with a ballet company, and there's like, you know, very world famous ballet. You know, it's a legacy of being attached to
the
Soviet Union.
Soviet.
But so in Cuba specifically, I think it's a good place to start. You know, we had this baseball game, and it was one of the most surreal moments of my life to walk into the stadium and have a bunch of Cubans go crazy for both Barack Obama and Raul Castro. But then there's Rachel Robinson, Jackie Robinson's wife. Cuba is a bit like Zelig in that they seem to be associated with everything, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis. But Jackie Robinson actually played baseball in Cuba before he came to the Major Leagues. I didn't even know that. So Rachel Robinson flew down on Air Force One with us, and Derek Jeter was there. And it was kind of, you'd look around and didn't know who you were going to see. But it was a common language, the baseball game. And like the absurd conflict between our governments looked even more ridiculous when you saw like a bunch of Cubans cheering a game between the Tampa Bay Devil Rays and the Cuban national team with like Jackie Robinson's widow in the stands. You know, like, what have we been doing all these years? What was the point of that, you know? There's a common language in baseball. There's a common language in music. There's an ability for collaboration. And frankly, I believe that the arts, you know, promote freedom of expression in the long run. And sometimes in governments that are closed, some of the only open space is in the arts, and the only ability to express yourself is in the arts. So I think those exchanges are very important. And I think, you know, globally, they're very important. And you know, we're cutting funding for this, and it is an enormous mistake. Because, like, think about what people like about America around the world is very rarely our foreign policy. You know, and this was true in the Cold War. You know, I mean, they like our culture, they like our sports, they like our entertainment, they like our tech. You know, when we go around the world, we go to Vietnam, they just are obsessed with Facebook in Vietnam. I mean, like, the number of people who are on Facebook in Vietnam, a country with a closed political system, couldn't stop Facebook because it was just caught on like such wildfire. And now that's an open space. And if you ask people in Russia or Cuba or China what they like about America, it's this. It is this part of California. They all want to have Silicon Valley. They all love Facebook. They all love Google. They all love, you know, Airbnb now. You know, and so we're now like cutting funding for exchange programs and cultural exchanges and athletic exchanges. We're just denying the U.S. government to be associated with that type of outreach. And that's an absurd thing to do. So, you know, I think more of that would allow us to reach people and have a conversation that governments can always have with people. And that's how we sustain our leadership in the world and frankly, leave some space for if you look at the arts, the values of pluralism and tolerance and diversity are often embedded in artistic collaboration in a way that is the antithesis of these right-wing populist neo-authoritarian movements that are sweeping the world. We could have a lot more like artistic and cultural and athletic engagement with other countries if we wanted to support liberal values. But my concern is that's part of what's on the cutting room floor of their State Department budget.
So we're out of time, Ben. You've been gracious with your time. Two very soundbitey kind of tweet-like answers to this. You were in the White House every single day that the president was there, President Obama. What was your worst day? What was your best day?
Boy, that's a tough question.
You can just go with your best day, then.
Yeah, no. The worst day. Um, There are actually a lot of bad days.
I shouldn't have brought it up so late in the day.
You know, I think the worst day was one of the worst days, because I'm sure, you know, someone could find and say, why didn't you think this day was worse? But was the first beheading of an American by ISIL. We were traveling to Martha's Vineyard. So I had to go tell the president about this and describe what was in this video of this beheading. And I think it was the worst day too, because not only did I, you know, grieve for the family, but I kind of knew from just having been around, like, what this was going to ignite. You know, there was going to be no way to stop the reaction to it in the United States, and then the kind of reaction in the Muslim world, and the kind of prominence that ISIL was going to, you could kind of see what was going to happen. And so that, you know, that was a very, very bad day.
What was your best day?
You know, I think my best day was when, you know, I walked into work on the morning of December 17th. I just knew this thing that, like, was going to happen in like 2 hours. And I remember having this very quiet moment where it's before the plane took off with Alan Gross on it, and you know, we announced all these things in coordination with the Cuban government. And just the feeling that something I'd worked very hard on, that I cared about, that also exemplified what Barack Obama, in my view, kind of stood for in the world, that was about to happen. And you can't do that kind of thing if you're not in government. I mean, there's things that you can do with your life that are really important. But there's certain things that you can only do when you're in government. And, you know, that was one of them. Ending the Cold War between the United States and Cuba, and just setting off everything that happened and not even knowing where it was going to lead. That was the best feeling, too. The best thing I said that could happen is if Americans and Cubans figure this out on their own without the governments in the way. But that was a good... that was a good feeling. And, you know, again, just to close on a comment on the current administration.
Sure you want to ruin the mood? Yeah. Ruin that mood?
My concern is, again, what is the role of the U.S. government in the world, right? I think we take for granted, you know, I said this earlier to some of the students, one of the things that used to be remarkable to me at the first days in this job is something would happen around the world, and we would put out a statement. And then the Europeans, the Japanese, you know, international organizations, you'd see that kind of message that we had communicated echoed, you know, without us even coordinating that. Like, they just looked to America to set the tone, right? And what made me think of that is with Cuba, we were setting a new tone. We were setting a tone that, we are resolving conflicts, and we... And I remember seeing the messages out of Latin America that were very emotional from a broad spectrum of ideologies in terms of the political leadership. And my concern is it's been like 6 weeks and we've already lost that, you know. And that the world isn't looking to the United States to set the tone and provide the leadership example and to speak up on behalf of things that we might not obviously care about. You know, why do we care so much about 11 million people in Cuba? Because we're America, and we care about everybody. And everybody's of equal value and equal worth and equal dignity. And now it seems like, you know, other countries, international institutions, within just a few weeks, are just making their own hedge. And that's something, losing that, is the beginning of losing American leadership at the center of an entire international order that has supported improvements in standards of living and human rights. I think that as we're debating tweets and crazy lies about Obama, and we're also need to step back and think about, you know, what else the United States government is not doing anymore that it just used to do, because that's who we are. And because what I loved about being in government in that moment is we were sending a message not just about Cuba. The big things you do in government are about everything. It's about how relations between nations and people should be. And that's something you can only do in government, because the United States government is the most important institution in the world, or one of them at least. And I think we have to be vigilant as citizens that if our government doesn't do that, that we have to do it ourselves.
Well, Ben, remember, we're a democracy, so there's always hope for renewal in terms of the bigger picture.
And that's why I ended on that note.
But just two things in closing. Thank you. Tremendous talk, very patient with a lot of interesting questions. You mentioned being in government. And I would just say being in government is a necessary condition to do things, but not sufficient, because there are a lot of people who are in government and don't do things.
I think about
my time in government. It's actually really hard to do something in government. That's my own personal experience. And you did something that was really big. You're part of a team that really did it. It sounds like nobody can take it away from you. Trump can't roll it back. So on behalf of all of us.
Let's not get too excited.
All right. Well, let's hope.
You can't change how the American and Cuban people feel. And that matters for
sure. All right. Well, that's a really big thing you've done. And just thank you for your service to our country.
Thanks for listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. Follow us on Twitter at FSI Stanford, or visit our website at fsi.stanford.edu for more events and expertise from the world of international studies.